From the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, you're listening to Earth First Radio. Stay tuned for No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music.
You're cutting chainsaws, killing the trees, something, everything that lives in peace. Our animal friends are on the run, but there's nowhere to go when the job is done. How can we stand by while this all takes place? We've got to stop this inhuman race.
And welcome to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. Every week I bring you No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music for activists on the front lines of the environmental movement. In the news, you'll hear about the folks who are killing the planet and the folks who have detailed information about saving what's left. They all have names, addresses, telephone numbers, fax numbers, email, and web addresses. So please go get a pencil or a pen and some recycled paper to write down the information, because this isn't couch potato radio. It's activist radio. And I urge you to take the information and act on it. You really can make a difference by writing letters, faxes, and making phone calls when you aren't out in the woods, up in a tripod or a tree sit, or locked down at the road blockade, or marching on the highway. If you have information, announcements, or comments for Earth First Radio, please keep your pencil handy and listen for the contact addresses later on in the show. And as always, we're going to start off with announcements. The Wildlife Society is sponsoring a conference on the ecology and management of dead wood in western forests. This is happening November 2nd through 4th in Reno, Nevada. Dead trees are critical elements of healthy forests. Snags and logs contribute to forests by mediating soil recruitment and loss, affecting water retention and movement, releasing minerals and nutrients for plants living nearby, and providing habitat for a myriad of species, including fungi, arthropods, and vertebrates. Historically, snag relationships with cavity nesting species have been the basis of deadwood research and management. More recently, the role of wood in aquatic ecosystems is becoming an important focus. How these and other factors affect forest management, including timber harvest and fire suppression, will be the focus of this conference. Once again, the Wildlife Society is sponsoring the conference November 2nd through 4th in Reno, Nevada. For registration information, contact William Hull at 510-465-4962. That's William at 510-465-4962, or send email to whull@cgbd.org. whull@cgbd.org. All right, in other news or announcements, the Grassroots Climate Education Project is doing stuff December 3rd through 5th. The Greenhouse Network, a nonprofit group dedicated to public education about the dangers of global warming, is seeking individuals from across the United States who wish to participate in their grassroots climate education project. A training session will be held on the weekend of December 3rd through 5th in Portland, Oregon, for 25 people, who will then make presentations to the public about the need for action to address global warming. You must apply for the training sessions. Contact Iban Goldstein of the Greenhouse Network for information about the application process. His address is by email, eban@lclark.edu. That's eban@lclark.edu. Also coming up is the Rocky Mountain Law Conference, the Northern Rocky Mountain Law Conference. American Wildlands will hold this conference October 30th and 31st, entitled Intersections, Water Quality, Water Quantity, and Native Species. Activists and attorneys will work to provide additional tools under federal and state laws for protection and restoration of the biological diversity of the Northern Rockies watersheds. Contact Judy Brower, B-A-W-E-R, for registration information at 406-586-8175. That number again, 406-586-8175. Or email to jbrawer@wildlands.org. jbrawer@wildlands.org, and the North American Industrial Hemp Council Conference, November 4th through 6th, 4th annual meeting of the North American Industrial Hemp Council. You know all the things that hemp will do. Well, one of them is reduce the need for forest products, also the need for oil and many other things. If you'd like more information about this conference that will be held in Chicago, Illinois, visit the website of www.naihc.org. That's www.naihc.org for further information about the Hemp Conference in Chicago, Illinois, November 4th through 6th. All right. You're on the network. Why don't you do something? It's called Hacktivism. An auto faxer in resistance to the unconstitutional grand jury system has been set up at, and here is the web address, excuse me, members@xoom.com/NAICHE/hacktivism, hacktivism/gina.htm. That web page again is members.zoom, xoom.com/NAICHE/hacktivism, hacktivism/Gina, gina.html, in response to the jailing of an animal rights activist from Santa Cruz for expressing her First Amendment rights about the imprisonment of whales and dolphins. She's been jailed and is on a hunger strike. The auto faxer is directed to the judge and U.S. attorney who imprisoned her. And more information can be found at that site, so get to it. All right, let's move into some news here. The wolf cries at Eagle Creek. The following is a transcript of a news story that appeared on Oregon Public Broadcasting Friday, October 8th. It looks like Mount Hood is gearing up their propaganda machine for a crackdown at the Eagle timber sale. They produce no proof that culverts have been blocked, and no one involved in the Eagle campaign believes them. They appear to be relying on gullible reporters who trust them without needing to see the proof. Well, who knows? The Forest Service is also claiming that, the Forest Service has also just opened the gate leading to the road blockade after it's been closed for 3 months because a few dozen hunters called and complained about it being locked. Of course, we had about a hundred times that many people call and ask that the sales be canceled, but they didn't listen to those members of the public already. Hunters have driven up and smashed a table used by the blockaders and knocked over the Forest Service signs. They fled when people woke up to videotape them. The Forest Service knows they are putting us in danger by unlocking the gate to armed, potentially hostile people. What's even more disturbing is that since the Oregonian's Yellow Journalism series on eco-terrorism, the Forest Service now throws the word terrorism around like it has no meaning. Call the Clackamas Ranger District at 503-630-8700. That's the Clackamas Ranger District. Their number, 503-630-8700. And the Mount Hood Forest Headquarters at 503-668-1700. That number for the Mount Hood Forest Headquarters is 503-668-1700 to complain about these dirty tricks. These folks up at the Eagle Creek Timber Sale need your help. The Eagle Creek Timber Sale is about 500 acres in size and situated on the western slope of Mount Hood. At about 30% of the trees have been already harvested, but the logging company that bought the sale hasn't cut any trees since the sale made news headlines earlier this summer. Environmentalists, many from the group Cascadia Forest Alliance, have blocked access to the area and organized a tree sit. It's been going on since June, I believe, to persuade the Forest Service to withdraw the sale. However, the Forest Service spokesman Glenn Sachet says finding the culverts blocked changed all that. He believes Cascadia Forest Alliance members were behind the act. They definitely crossed the line now from simple illegal protesting that we've been tolerating to environmental terrorism. Sachet says, those 11 culverts provide essential drainage, and the only reason to plug them would be to wash out the road. While there is no factual evidence pointing at the protesters, he says there is plenty of circumstantial evidence. It's very interesting that it's only occurred on the road behind the illegal blockade. Sachet said the gate to the road has been locked since July, so no vehicles could have been driven up to clog the culverts. He doesn't say that there's cars in the culverts, however. And he says the culverts are often blocked as an environmental protest, but Ivan Malusky, the Cascadia Alliance spokesperson, says his group knows nothing whatsoever about trying to destroy the road. Malusky, this is not something that we do as a group engage in. We engage in really public, nonviolent civil disobedience, and there's no reason to do that to these roads up here. He says what's disturbing is that the Forest Service appears to be using the incident as an excuse to crack down on the protest in the Eagle Creek watershed. Cascadia Forest Alliance neither condemns nor condones culvert blocking, but Malusky says the Forest Service needs to put this incident in perspective, Malusky, and so to say that someone putting some rocks in a culvert to wash out a road is an act of terrorism, somehow comparable to the Oklahoma City bombing or murdering an abortion doctor, is quite far-fetched and somewhat perplexing. No more cutting is expected this winter, but loggers may start work again in the spring. All right. And in other news about Eagle Creek, in response to Mount Hood's Forest decision to open the gate leading to Eagle Creek road blockade, activists will begin regular caravans by car to resupply the ongoing nonviolent protest over roadless area and municipal watershed logging. The first Eagle Creek Peace Caravan will haul supplies such as firewood, canned goods, and winter clothing on Saturday, October 16th, and probably many other days too. That caravan will form up in the parking lot behind KBOO. I believe that's KBOO is in Eugene, Oregon. Please get as much stuff as you can together and join us. It's going to be a long, wet, and cold winter, and we need to resupply the base camp now. They'll arrive at base camp by noon and be able to get back home by 2. If you can't come but can donate material, please give the Cascadia Forest Alliance a call. Their number is 503-978-1054, and I know you folks up there in Eugene get Earth First Radio, I believe it's on Tuesdays. So this is going to be old news for you, but I'm sure Cascadia Forest Alliance can use help. So give them a call, 503-978-1054. And for immediate release on Tuesday, October 12th, conservationists from Cascadia Forest Alliance, Witness Against Lawless Logging and Oregon Wildlife Federation will hold a press conference. That's over with. But they expressed their serious concerns that the Forest Service is creating an atmosphere of violence at Eagle Creek road blockade. The Forest Service is maintaining that the activists are now eco-terrorists, claiming the culverts in the area behind the road blockade have been filled in allegedly by the activists. The activists at Eagle Creek have no knowledge of how the culverts were filled. The Oregonian, in its recent front page four-part series on eco-terrorism, left the readers with clear impressions that all environmental direct actions are violent expressions of eco-terrorism. The Forest Service, taking its cue from the Oregonian, is knowingly branding the totally nonviolent activities at the Eagle Base Camp as eco-terrorism. We believe that this is setting the stage for a major confrontation by the Forest Service, which would endanger the lives of nonviolent activists. We are calling on the Oregonian and the Forest Service to cease and desist from further inflammatory remarks and actions, and to recognize the right of a citizen to pursue their First Amendment rights of nonviolent protest. We further call on the Oregonian to make perfectly clear to the Forest Service and the public that the term eco-terrorism does not in any way reflect what is occurring at Eagle Creek. Responsible journalism requires this situation be faced up to directly and corrective actions be taken immediately. And we already heard about the peace caravan that's going to be going up there. So, anyway, things are happening up in Oregon. Moving into California, the Trust for Public Land, a San Francisco-based nonprofit organization, has purchased 1,000 acres in the San Felipe Valley to be managed for wildlife and recreation. The property, valued at $2 million, is part of the Trust for Public Land's ongoing effort to protect San Diego's backcountry. TPL transferred the land to the State Wildlife Conservation Board to be managed by the California Department of Fish and Game. The Trust for Public Land and our public agencies and nonprofit partners have worked hard for more than 6 years to protect the Rutherford Ranch. Together we've made significant progress, says Bob Flewelling, TPL's senior project manager. The transaction, funded by the California voter-approved Habitat Conservation Fund, is the 11th acquisition of in TPL's Rutherford Ranch project to protect thousands of acres, linking a network of public recreation land, open space, and wildlife habitat stretching from the Pacific Ocean through inland forests to the California deserts. To date, the Trust for Public Land has protected 5,500 acres of the ranch. The valley hosts a wide variety of wildlife due to the year-round San Felipe Creek, a dependable water supply in an arid semi-desert region. Acquisition of lands within the San Felipe Valley represents a unique opportunity to assure the long-term protection of the biologically rich valley, says Randy Botta, wildlife biologist for the California Department of Fish and Game. San Felipe Valley appears to be one of, if not the most important, inland flyways for migratory birds in San Diego County. And activist Julia Butterfly Hill will publish the story of her fight to save California's ancient redwood trees, Harper of San Francisco announced last week. On December 10th, Hill climbed a 1,000-year-old, 200-foot-tall redwood tree named Luna to protest logging of old-growth redwood forests in Northern California by the Pacific Lumber Company, a division of the Houston-based Maxam Corporation. Hill has remained in Luna for over 650 days, during which she has been buzzed by company helicopters and endured storms. Company security guards once put Luna under siege for 10 days in an effort to cut off her supplies. And Hill's vigil has drawn international attention to the redwoods. She has delivered keynote addresses via cellular telephone to environmental conferences, served as a panelist on the United Nations Commission on Human Settlements, and received an honorary doctorate degree of humanities from the New College of California School of Humanities. Hill's publisher, Division of HarperCollins, plans to release The Legacy of Luna, the story of a tree, a woman, and the struggle to save the redwoods in the spring of the year 2000. The first-person account will be published on paper that is made up of 70% Forestry Stewardship Council certified paper, which meets requirements for sustainable forest practices and the protection of indigenous cultures, biodiversity, and employee relations in the areas where the wood is harvested. It will be bleached using a chlorine-free process that does not emit dioxins and furans. All of the author's profits will go to the Circle of Life Foundation, a forest organization that she established. And, all right. Wait. We are all waiting for Julia's book. And action is needed now. Until recently, the largest active mining operation in the national park has been in the Mojave National Preserve. The Sima Cinder Mining Operation was removing up to 10,000 tons of cinders from a cinder cone annually. Sima Cinder is part of a national natural landmark within the preserve, designated as such in 1978 because of its special and unique volcanic features. This operation has been operating illegally for several years, which finally prompted several environmental organizations to warn the National Park Service that they would sue if the agency did not make the mining operation comply with federal laws. In August, the Mojave National Preserve shut down operations at the Sima Cinder Mine and told the mine operators that they could not resume operations until they were in compliance with all applicable laws. And for over 2 years, the National Parks Conservation Association has urged the preserve to bring Sima under the full regulatory authority of the Mining in the Parks Act, the California Desert Protection Act, and the National Environmental Policy Act. The fact that the mine operators had neither an approved plan of operations nor a completed validity exam made the entire operation illegal. Though mining is permitted in some national park units under the 1872 mining law, the National Park Service is required by several laws to regulate mining to minimize degradation of national park units. The National Park Service gave the mine operator temporary approval in 1995 to continue operations to provide some time to comply with the NPS regulations. But the temporary approval expired in 1996, and the mine has continued to impair park resources. It is clearly time to close the mine, and the Park Service should be applauded for its actions. Unfortunately, Senator Dianne Feinstein is considering legislation to allow the mine to reopen its operations. The National Park Conservation Association and other environmental groups are not opposed to the mine's operation. We only want to see it operate under the proper regulations so that park resources are not impaired. Until such time, the mine should remain closed. California residents should immediately contact Dianne Feinstein's office. Ask her to support the National Park Service decision to shut down the Sima Cinder Mine until it complies with federal laws that were created to protect our public lands for future generations. Contact Dianne Feinstein. Here's her address. Senator Dianne Feinstein, U.S. Senate, Washington, D.C., 20510. That's Senator Dianne Feinstein, U.S. Senate, Washington, D.C., 20510. And you can phone her in Washington. Her number is 202-224-3841. That's 202-224-3841. Or in San Francisco at 415-536-6868. Once again, her office in San Francisco, 415-536-6868. And we thank the National Park Conservation Association for that information. And in other news from national parks, just across the southern border of Sequoia National Park in the watershed of the Tule River lies the largest privately owned stand of giant sequoias, the 1,500-acre Dillonwood Grove. Forming part of one of the five largest groves of giant sequoias in existence, Dillonwood now presents conservationists with a great opportunity and a terrible threat. Dillonwood is for sale. The family that has owned and managed this forest property for 40 years has determined they must sell. Due to their good stewardship of the grove so far, they would prefer that the land become public property. But if that doesn't succeed, they will have to put the land on the open market, where a local timber company has already expressed a strong interest in buying it. In addition to the 159 monarch trees, the truly ancient ones, Dillonwood contains healthy, multi-age second-growth giant sequoia forest that is unusually diverse. The property is also rich in wildlife and contains an 1,800-year-old archaeological site and a 19th-century sawmill. The Save the Redwoods League has obtained a 2-year option on the property in the hopes that it can be added to the Sequoia National Park, reuniting the ecological unit of the Dillonwood-Garfield Grove. The first urgent need is for Congress to expand the boundary of Sequoia National Park to include Dillonwood's 1,500 acres. The next step is for California's leaders in Congress to build support for funding the acquisition of the land with money from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. So contact Senator Dianne Feinstein, U.S. Senate, Washington, D.C., 20510, and encourage her to add Dillonwood to Sequoia National Park and pay for it. Sounds good to me. And let's see here. Trying to dig through our news today. The big news of the day, the news that is cutting across all the wire services, is of course the roadless area declaration by our president, William Jefferson Clinton. Apparently upwards of 40 million acres of land in the United States that is currently roadless is going to be declared forever road free. And this is a giant victory if it can happen, and hopefully it will. But it's not without controversy here. Let's get into some of the controversy surrounding the Clinton announcement of the roadless area policy. Here it is. I've got to say I've been waiting for someone to point out at least for West Side, Oregon, and Washington, a roadless area policy really doesn't do much for biodiversity or hydrology. Why? Because of the vast majority of old growth cutting in the GIF, Mount Hood, Willamette, and Umpqua National Forest takes place in extremely fragmented, low-elevation old growth forests. The Detroit Ranger District in the Willamette is a case in point. Detroit serves as Salem, Oregon's municipal watershed. How many non-wilderness roadless areas over 5,000 acres are there? My map shows zero. The U.S. Forest Service has done such a complete job of roading and clear-cutting the district that they are insulated from these sorts of roadless wilderness initiatives. Another good hydrologic example is the Middle Santiam Wilderness Area. It is well over 5,000 acres, yet the Middle Santiam is basically a scoured-out dead river due to clear-cutting upstream. Protecting isolated parcels, no matter how large, without a hydrological or ecological understanding of the ecosystem really doesn't get us where we want to go. I'd suggest doing everything we can to work for protection of the remaining old growth and connectivity corridors between roadless areas to keep them from becoming isolated island ecologies that lose their biological and hydrological values. And with that said, we have gotten closer to the serious protection of 40 million acres of public lands and raised the visibility of the value of the remaining roadless areas, and for that a great many activists deserve a lot of thanks. We've still got a long road to hoe, however, especially for those of us who love West Side old growth in Oregon and Washington and Northern California. I'm plugging away at West Side triage through monitoring and appeals, trying to working on trying to get the Northwest Forest Plan scrapped, and of course doing what I can for the Forest Protection and Restoration Act. Get a hold of me. Okay, and then that's your pal George, and George Sexton, by the way. And here's some more news. I have read with interest Clinton's remarks and positive response from the big money environmental groups. What I'm very curious about right now is whether any other conservationist sees the big flaws in this roadless area approach to biodiversity and big natural resource protection. Water, number one. Though water originated from the protected upper watersheds might be clean and low in contaminants, if it then passes through an increasingly degraded lower watershed, the net effect may be no improvement. If the price tag for no logging in the upper watershed is increased logging in down below, there may be no benefit at all. In forest productivity and biodiversity, the lowlands are generally better for this in this respect, but the big roadless areas are in the higher elevations, so protecting the roadless areas, you are protecting higher elevation sites. This is an old argument, and therefore not protecting the older, lower, fragmented landscape that can support more wildlife when it's in good condition. Again, displacement of extraction activities and giving a political public sense of having accomplished a great deal may result in no benefit because getting the lower down stuff will now become more difficult. And in terms of fragmentation, the lack of connectivity in north, south, and east, west directions is much more of an issue at lower elevations because of past and present extractions and the rural development activities. Thus, resolving fragmentation for movement of wildlife and maintenance of ecological processes is more critical for lower elevations right now than for higher. I would go so far as to say that exclusive protection of higher elevations at the political and resource expense of the lower elevations will cause extinction of many bird, mammal, amphibian, and fish species, the majority of which live in lower elevations. And there are some other problems, too. In addition to the above is the question of how we can get to the point that the Clinton-Gore could make this proposal and use it in an election year to successfully look green with the apparent support of big-money environmentalists. Have the last two decades of ecology and conservation biology been ignored? This is the same kind of problem we had with the Headwaters debacle, where Big Green made a deal look like a victory, when actually it was a multi-party capitulation to bigger money, complete with, but it could have been worse, and look at what we gained, and but we worked so hard on this. The logging industry counts on low-elevation logging activities to support itself. It therefore doesn't care if we get the high-elevation stuff. So we get more 1960s-style parks, dramatic ridgelines with gnarled trees, great alpine hiking, and a marmot or two if we're lucky. I thought we'd learned that the parks are not where it is at all if we want protection of large numbers of species. Apparently not. The solution? Advocate the hardest for the protection of public lands starting at lower elevations and work up. Wilderness patches and corridors, including the interface between the scrub grassland and the hardwood or hardwood and conifer forests, will go much farther than exclusively protecting high-elevation conifers. This will require restoration and enforcement, but it is one answer to the problem of declining biodiversity on public lands. Even if one taxes the cynical and politically correct view, that one function of public lands is de facto mitigation for destructive practices on private lands, you still want to protect those lands closest in type to those being modified, i.e. the nearby low-elevation public lands. This is a hard job, as many before us have found out, but it is still essential work. As usual, raining on the parade, from Fraser Schilling, Davis scientists with various hats. North First Radio will be right back.